I've said for many years, and I have really had that feeling buttressed a great deal by reading a recent book, that we are in now a bizarre repetition of those events that transpired in the 1930s, about 1935 to 1939, prior to World War II. And I'm going to recommend some reading to you, if you would. I have been wading very slowly because it is very tedious and very difficult in reading. You don't read it very rapidly. This one called We Slept at Dawn, or rather, I'm sorry, At Dawn We Slept. The hard book is, I think, around $12.95 or even $15, but the paperback is quite thick, about this thick and about that tall. It has a portion of the Japanese flag on it. It's about $7 and something. This is the result of more than 30 years study, thorough documentation, access to the various Navy departments, Army departments, war offices, etc., of both the Japanese and the American governments, by the author, who deceased just before the final preparation of the manuscript. And I am just now about two-thirds of the way through the book to the portion where the attack at Pearl Harbor actually began. Now, that is only a part of what I would urge you to read. I have some others, but of course, if you haven't read William Shearer's Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, then certainly that is recommended reading for everyone. Another very important book is Inside the Third Reich, and I forget the name of the author. But if you have not studied the history of how the world went to war and lost 30 million lives, of how every nation on the face of the earth was to a greater or lesser degree involved in the most titanic struggle in the history of all of humankind, of the incredible number of divine miracles and interventions that had to take place in the course of that war, or the Allies simply would not have won, at the incredible number of lies we were told, the innocence, the ridiculous rumors, the brainwashing, the almost juvenile lack of preparedness of the United States of America, the attitude that we had after the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, is just unbelievable. The total chaos that struck in Honolulu and on the West Coast, people running around like chickens with their heads cut off, not knowing exactly what in the world to do. And if the Japanese had wanted, of course, to land on Oahu, they certainly could have done so with ease, because even in their wildest dreams, they could not have expected the success that they achieved. I'm not going to go into great detail there. I will leave that up for your reading and study, but it does bear a great deal of study, and there are some fantastic parallels taking place right now, not the least of which is in that daily concern of all of us, money, jobs, the economy, a next possible round of runaway inflation, which is probably the only way the government is going to avoid deeper recession or total collapse of international financial establishments, is the fueling of the American and other Western European economies by another inflationary cycle. And the only way that can be done is by Volcker and the Fed letting go of the tight money policy, allowing it little by little, if a genuine recovery does not occur. Even though President Reagan is said to be an optimist, a recent very in-depth article in Time magazine bears your reading, which was an interview with Time Life reporters who went with the president, talked to Nancy Reagan, talked to all of the White House advisors, talked to members of his cabinet, talked to men in the Pentagon, and tried to assess and to appraise what kind of a man is at the helm of American government. You might in some ways be tempted to liken Ronald Reagan to Herbert Hoover. That was a Republican administration which brought about the great collapse of the American economy. Now, in those days, and I won't wade into this because this bears several volumes of reading into the way the stock market operates, the creation of the Fed itself and the IMF, and the various checks and balances that are in place against the kind of incredible speculation that took place in the stock market in the 1920s, when only 8% of the populace of the United States had about 92% of its wealth. And it is incredible when you see the way the stock market operated in that era and that time as opposed to the way it operates today. And again, I'll leave that up to you. I want to go back, and maybe we can even have a little bit of a refresher to keep you awake, because this could get a little tedious for some people, especially if you were born after 1945. And I realize that. When I was a boy playing in Eugene, Oregon, the boy across the street would show me his father's leggings and the ancient old stuff. And to me, that had mothballs and cobwebs on it, and was something that must have happened in about 1612. The idea that World War I had occurred and had come to a conclusion only 11 years before my birth just simply did not impact itself upon my consciousness. Now as I look back, and I'm looking at 53 coming around here in a month and a half or so, believe it or not, 11 years just goes whipping by. And certainly 3 to 5 years is just like a summer, and it's gone. And it's hard for me, and I think maybe it's appropriate on the very first day, the way we count it with Roman calendars, of 1983, the way we count time, of a new year, to reflect on 1982, what happened in the course of this year that has gone by in the work as well as in the world, and to project forward and ask ourselves, what will the world be like? And what will the Church of God International be like, this congregation in Tyler, in January of 1984? 82 was a year I was glad to see go. It was an ugly year, a bizarre year. In many ways, the only happy events that I remember were moving into this new building, the ministerial conference, the inaugural Sabbath, the Feast of Tabernacles, a few events that were highlights in the year in the church. A year, for the first time, since some crises back during which Mr. Wayne Cole, Mr. Portoon, who preached with us at the feast in 1979, Jack Martin, and some other people who were here and people in the work left, and we were, of course, then in an erosion or a depletive cycle of some sort from which we have finally recovered and bottomed out. I can give you the good news, if it is good news, that most of all the biggies in radio and television, according to the radio, television, and the media, are unable to pay radio and TV bills. Dr. Schuller, just this last couple of weeks, had his California state income tax exemption taken away from him. They are appealing that in court. He has been thrown off many radio and television stations, as have some of the others, such as Jerry Falwell and the like. The word is out that they are down in the 20th to the 30th percentile as a result of recessionary influences on the vast numbers of people upon whom they depend for their support. The positive news, though I can't give you specific figures, is that the work of God here in Tyler ended up the year in the black for the first time in 3 years, but that degree of increase may well be much larger than we think. And I'm not ballyhooing, I'm not stretching anything, for the simple reason that if we, like any other organization, have also suffered a significant amount of attrition as a result of recessionary influences, then the replacement of that attrition has been rapid enough, not only to totally overcome it, but even to more than overcome it and to put us in the black at the end of the year. We are hopeful of projecting up to a 5% increase in the month of January over the same month for the preceding year. And I believe and I hope that will be true, and I can certainly underline that what Keith said about it being in the spiritual area, as well as, of course, in every other area, but the spiritual does come first. It reminded me of several sermons that I preached and asking questions about what do we need most, more money, more intelligent young men, more leadership, more buildings, more facilities, more vehicles, more anything you can mention. And of course, the answer is no. We don't need that anywhere near so much as we need more of God's Holy Spirit. And then all that comes with that, which is more zeal and more dedication and more hard work and all the other things that will follow. But that certainly has always been true in God's work. So as I look back at all of the horrible things that happened in 1982, the invasion of Lebanon, the American and the European multilateral peacekeeping force that then was evacuated, and very shortly thereafter, the new president was assassinated together with about 50 of his cohorts in the bombing of their headquarters in Beirut, the Israeli occupation, the subsequent assassination of those hundreds, perhaps we will never know how many, 1,000 or more, men, women, and children, and even animals, anything that moved in the streets of the refugee camps in Lebanon. I saw recently a complete potpourri, a recapitulation of all the events of 1982 on one of the major networks in a very rapid fashion. And it was a sickening thing. The Tylenol poisonings, the horrible things that are happening in the world at large almost makes a very hollow mockery out of all the party-going and the drunken Happy New Year. Because, you know, they said it on January 1st, 1981. And on January 1st, 1982. And we see people by the millions saying it again. But will it really be a Happy New Year? Now, in the new year of 1936, the Weimar Republic was collapsing. Adolf Hitler had already come to power. The famous putsch that put him in jail with some of the people who were his top henchmen, among them Ernst Röhm, had succeeded to the point beyond their wildest expectations after his publication of Mein Kampf. He had actually wrested control of the NAZI, which merely stood for the Nationalist Socialist Party of Germany. And I can't pronounce every one of the German words that the Nazi, which is merely the English abbreviation of the German term, really stood for. Many people call it Nazi or Nazi or Nazi or whatever. But usually the newsmen in this country call it the Nazi Party. But it was the National Socialist Party of Germany at that time. Strangely, and the parallels, of course, that I might even apply personally and to the work of God and to many other major corporations for that matter, by the time of Hitler's total seizure of power, even some of his original henchmen that had helped launch him to power, Ernst Röhm among them, were assassinated. But finally, old Bismarck was dead, Hitler was in complete power, and the world was in total poverty. I was 6 years of age, living in Eugene, Oregon, toddling off to the first grade in Lincoln High School, in a day and age where I had to cut out cardboard inserts to put in the shoes that I wore, where we were cold and hungry, we didn't have enough to eat, we lived in the outskirts of town in a house that badly needed painting. Most of the time the septic system overflowed. It was very, very shoddy, and we were really on the margin of poverty and quite poor. In those days, I would work for 5 cents a day. I would work 8 hours a day doing office work, and I would be paid a nickel. But then a nickel would buy a quart of milk. Of course, there are other ways of looking at that, which you need to bear in mind. That is, if you just applied it to the number of hours it took to work to buy a car, or the number of hours it took to work to buy a quart of milk, we may be somewhat, believe it or not, better off today than we were then, because it actually costs less hours of work for the average American to buy a car today than it did in 1930. But on with my story. Very, very quickly, some of the short-sightedness of the architects of the Treaty of Versailles began to be bandied about. Now, we have a very great parallel of that today. A lot of times we totally forget because it has been the post-World War II status quo that Europe is divided and that in the midst of a divided Europe lies divided Germany, and that Germany, divided not quite in half because the bulk of it is in the eastern part of Germany, in the midst of the East is a divided city. A little enclave far over there, a couple hundred more miles inside East Germany, is West Berlin. The cultural, economic, and the political, and I would say the moral or the spiritual capital of Germany. The only capital that exists in German hearts and minds is Berlin. It is not Bonn, a sleepy little village on the Rhine River down in the south of Germany at all. And even though Köln and Essen and some of the other big cities, Mainz, Wuppertal among them, are giants of burgeoning industry and steel factories and refineries and so on, and some of the big names like Daimler, Benz, and Siemens and some of the other big German manufacturers, and they are the center, of course, of manufacturing and trade and production, they are not the nationalistic capital of Germany. Leaders in Germany will continually tell you that all that happens in Europe must be viewed in the context of a divided Europe, a divided Germany, and a divided Berlin. What is the parallel that some of you in this room could think of that led toward Hitler marching into various areas of Europe that had been imposed upon the Germans following the armistice in 1918? Anybody think of a major area in which there were losses of territory, in which German people, German nationals, German ethnic, German-speaking peoples lived. You can name three or four right quickly. One of the most important flies in the ointment, anybody remember?
Rhineland.
The Rhineland is one. The whole area along the Rhine was to be a demilitarized zone, and it was under control of the Western Allies, and the Germans were absolutely commanded by terms of the Treaty of Versailles, signed in the railroad car down to the south of Paris, the very same car that Adolf Hitler had pulled up to the very same spot where he took the French surrender and did his little jig and did his little dance by the side of the car that you've seen in the documentaries, no doubt. That was a great day for Hitler. The Rhineland was one of the first, but there were several more. The Sudetenland, that merely meant a southern area, it was the extreme western part of Czechoslovakia, which was ethnically German. But one of the biggest of all was the Danzig Corridor, which led to what is today a part of East Germany and up into Prussia, which led to the port city of Danzig on the Baltic, a major German port city. And there was a narrow little corridor there, and there was an area between Danzig and Germany proper that was controlled by the Prussian, not the Prussian, but the other three governments up there, and the Russians. And, of course, these and other impositions of various mandates on German territory, among them, remember, the Gilberts and the Marshalls in the West Pacific, had originally been German. They were taken away by the Treaty of Versailles. Kenya, Tanganyika, the East African highlands of the Lake region were German, but you remember them as being British because they ended up being a British mandate as a result of the Treaty of Versailles. Now, not only that, but stop to think about all that you remember about the incredible collapse of the Western economies and how the Germans suffered. And look at some of the pictures. I have one in here called Sieg Heil. It's about that thick, and it's a picture book about this big, and is an incredible documentary of the rise of Adolf Hitler to power with never-before-seen pictures, I think, that actually came from German and Nazi publications and so on. It's absolutely fascinating. And in that book, you learn of the poverty of those people, of bread and food lines, four abreast around four blocks, people waiting in line for a little bit of meat, which they could only get maybe once a week, and the incredible hardship on people who were on a starvation level. Now, in a complete breakdown of international finance, what do you basically have? Just think about money for a minute. You know, you can't burn money. Excuse me. You can burn it and stay warm by it, but other than that, it is of no value except as the clerk to whom you give it thinks it is of value. It has no intrinsic value of itself. The government stands behind it, and as long as you have confidence in the government and confidence in your money, the money is good. When that confidence is gone, the money is no longer any good. And then, of course, even gold, you might say ultimately, is the same, except that basically gold tends to be that yellow metal that survives all the collapses of various paper currencies and various other mediums of exchange among the nations. When a complete breakdown of international trade took place and a complete collapse of the Western economies, then nationalistic governments could issue nationalistic scrip. They could simply take, based upon their own control in their own borders, whatever monetary standard they desired. The international banking and financial situation prior to World War II was nowhere near so complex as it is today. Nor were there anywhere near so many holdings by major foreign powers inside the United States. Nor did the United States have anywhere near the investments inside Europe or Japan as it has today. In Canada, if you read an article recently in the recent issue that you received of our own paper by Mr. Desmond Burke, some of the concern of the Canadian people is not unlike the concern of the United States. Believe it or not, some of the major railways, Pan American Airlines, blue chip stocks by the dozens, not the least of which is GM, are partially owned and deeply indebted to and involved with foreign investments. Many of the foreign automobiles you buy are actually built inside the United States. The Chevy Love, not built in the United States necessarily. It may be assembled here, but it's built in Japan. Many American names on American products are actually produced inside the European Common Market or inside Japan, where labor costs are far less, and they can actually produce with American raw materials. They can ship, for example, American steel out of the port of Houston to West Germany, take it on the barges in the Kiel Canal from the port of Rotterdam, the biggest business in the world, into the heartland of the Rhineland of Germany, take it to Essen or Köln or whatever, or to Wolfsburg, turn it into a Volkswagen, take it back on a Volkswagen-owned barge, put it aboard a huge, big Volkswagen container ship, and you see them in Long Beach and San Pedro and the ports of our country with a big VW on the stack, and they're about five city blocks long, and here are tens of thousands of little Volkswagens and buses on them, and they come to the Volkswagen distribution centers in the United States, and there they are sold, and all of that is done more cheaply by the Germans using our steel than our own automobile makers can do it right in Houston or the Dallas-Fort Worth area to take our steel and convert them into automobiles and sell them to you. Yet all of that vast shipping cost is involved. Now, I want you to just, as I click off a few points here for you to think about, try to get a handle on one major important thing. Prophecies do not happen just because God says they happen. Any major prophecy you can look at that was fulfilled in the past would have dozens of easily understandable points or major occurrences that gave that development impetus, whether it was the attack by Shalmaneser on northern Israel and the removal of the Israelites into captivity, whether it was the attack by a later Babylonian empire upon the Assyrian empire, whether it was Darius the Mede coming into Babylon, whether it was the fall of Rome in 476, whether it was General Belisarius putting it back together somewhat weakly in 554, all of that having to do with the healing of the deadly wound of the beast that is actually portrayed in the 13th chapter of Revelation, it is not something that takes place in secret codes that we find in cereal boxes. Prophecy does not belong in comic books. Prophecy is not esoteric. Prophecy is the result, basically, of what would otherwise appear to a carnal-minded person who didn't know the Bible to be the logical outcome of logical events by the hundreds and would seem to be an inescapable outcome of those events. And the prophecies that have to do with the emergence of a beast power, with the imposition of the mark of the beast, with the advancement of a multilateral force under that beast into the Middle East and the setting up of a papal office of some sort in Jerusalem, will come about as the logical, natural, easily understandable outcome of hundreds of events. All of those hundreds of events are basically in place and they are working today. The events today taking place in Germany, and you can look at a dozen different directions, look at it from a financial or economic standpoint. The Germans are furious at the United States. All of our Western European allies are furious at Kemp Roth and supply-side economics and Reaganomics, and European publications are ridiculing it and making fun of it, and they can't stand what Volcker and the Fed are doing, and our own attempt to clean up our own financial mess by, of course, preventing the runaway inflationary cycle, has thrown us into a recessionary cycle, which makes the dollar far stronger on overseas markets, which means their currencies cannot compete as well as they used to, which throws them into an economic recession as well. Balance of payments deficits, that is the difference between imports and exports, begin to mount. They are experiencing now terrible unemployment in West Germany, in the Benelux countries, in France. Italy is totally bankrupt. If it weren't for the goodwill of the IMF and the United States and England, England is close to bankruptcy. Our big cities are bankrupt. The United States, if the truth were known, is virtually bankrupt. And the entire world economy and financial situation is hanging by a thread. Now, the scenario that I see in a bizarre repetition of World War II is first of all going to be a financial or an economic collapse. I don't know that that's going to happen in 1983. I don't think it will. I think, and it's only what I think, because other economists, and I'm not an economist, would disagree with me. I can run in here and get Europe magazine and a recent edition about 2 weeks ago of the Wall Street Journal with a very penetrating article to this effect, and Time magazine and U.S. News and World Report and several others that I have amassed together to put together a few articles on the subject, perhaps four in all, and show you that many economists are making such statements as they wouldn't be a bit surprised if a total collapse of the international financial organization or system of today did not come late in 1983 if the American economy does not produce some sort of a meaningful recovery in 1983. The indicators are just not there. Whether there is going to be a recovery or not may be completely artificial. In the meantime, of course, you know what's happening with regard to the incredible, eventually up into the trillions of dollars expenditure for the MX missile. They're arguing about the deployment of it, but not the creation of the missile. The B-1 bomber, recommissioning such antiquated ships as the New Jersey, alongside which I operated when I was in the Navy and saw that ship many, many times, over in Korea. That battleship was basically old then. The day of the battleship was no longer after the great carrier battles of Lingayen and Leyte Gulf and the landings on Luzon and the landings in Kwajalein. The day of the battleship was over. From that time on, they were used in fleet support roles and bombardment prior to the landings, amphibious landings, but no more were capital ships going to fight capital ships. As a matter of fact, it only took place twice in the entirety of World War II where major capital ships battled each other. The rest of the time, great fleets were locked in combat, totally out of sight of each other, by the aircraft of aircraft carriers. Now, because they put some missiles on the battleship, there may be some argument that that was a very viable decision. Personally, from my own experience, what I know and what I feel and think, that is one of the greatest wastes of money, if you're looking at it purely from the American nationalistic point of view, that you could imagine. We needed a battleship at sea like we need a hole in the head. But the government can't see that, and it's part of conventional forces and trying to upgrade them into nuclear-type forces with, of course, those missiles that they have aboard. How close are we to a complete economic collapse? I don't know. I would not be a bit surprised but that the winter of 1983 sees that happen. If not, I would not begin to guess that three full years will go by before a major disruption of the world financial system will occur. Now, what happens when the world financial system breaks down? First, what percentage of trade would you say West Germany depends upon for its survival, its millions of jobs, its industrial base, and its national economy in the United States, Britain, France, the Benelux countries, the Scandinavian countries, England, and the Commonwealth? Because none of those will be a part of the United States of Europe. I believe that with all of my being, or I wouldn't be standing here, and I can comment on that a little later on. The key to prophecy, the biggest key of all, is the identity of Israel, the identity of the United States of America and Britain in these chapters of the Bible. Daniel, of course, Hosea, all of them that we can mention, Isaiah, the rest of them, that is the major key. Who are we in the Bible? And what does it say about what is going to happen to us? What I want to do is to make some sense to the order of events, to admit that they can come crashing in on us a lot faster than we might think, but to also say these things do take time. A financial collapse, a complete breakdown of an economy, brings about martial law almost immediately, even an undeclared state of martial law. It will bring about total chaos in the big cities. Big cities subsist. You could look at the microcosm, let's say, of any city you want to, New York, Los Angeles, take Dallas, Fort Worth, whatever you'd like. And just imagine in Los Angeles, let's say, 6 million home freezers, 6 million refrigerators, 6 million families or so, or maybe that's too many, but from Santa Barbara to San Diego, I doubt it's probably even more than that. And think about all those supermarkets with all those heads of lettuce. and all those little bunches of radishes and all those gallons of milk and all those Safeways and all the meat markets with their slices of beef. Now, if you were to come from Bakersfield to Los Angeles about 3 a.m., 4 a.m. some morning, late at night, way before dawn, you would be just in an endless line of trucks. And those trucks, great big huge semis, a lot of them are reefer or cooler trucks. Some of them are coming from out around Thousand Palms or Palm Springs, out around the Coachella Valley, and down around Imperial Valley near the Mexican border. Did you know that 46% of all the vegetables grown in the United States are grown in California? And did you know that those cities exist almost like you as your own body does by a continual ingestion of food and energy every single day? That every morning from 3, 4 a.m. in the major big markets where the truck farmers are coming in, your Safeway and your Ralph's and Piggly Wiggly and Cash and Carry, all your big chains are down there with their agents shouting and waving their arms in the air, and it's just total chaos if you ever go down there, bidding on a truckload of lettuce and a truckload of cucumbers and a truckload of spinach and a truckload of beets and so on, and buying. Now, in the meantime, many of the big ones, like Kroger and Safeway, and, of course, even we have one right here in Tyler that is a very large chain in the southeastern United States, Brookshire's, have their own fleets of trucks. I think they took down the fences and the pillboxes around Brookshire's when they expanded, but maybe they're still there. Have you seen those here in Tyler out on the South Loop here? Brookshire's Warehouse. They did have a military fence, and the wire goes out completely around with a big open area, but they expanded way toward the east, and they built a bigger part of their warehouse and a truck lot out there, and there sticking up ominously were a couple of concrete and brick pillboxes with gun slits in them. And so you knew, and I talked to Woody Brookshire about it, when they designed the place, they designed it with food wars in mind. They designed it with the idea cranked into their awareness that at some point in time in the future, if a complete breakdown in the economy came, if suddenly the United States were plunged into poverty, if a complete breakdown, therefore, in transportation came, if the trucks simply stopped and the rails simply stopped feeding the voracious appetites of the big cities, mobs will come storming out of their neighborhoods and try to take for themselves the dwindling means of survival, predominantly food, medicines, clothing, and so on, pretty much in that order. So they built those pillboxes. Now, again, all of that takes time. If you ever read Philip Wiley's book called Tomorrow, which is like a novel, but it is set in the likelihood of a nuclear attack upon the United States, it pretty much portrays what would happen, not only in the major cities, but in the hinterland of the villages and the towns, if we suddenly had word that New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, and we wouldn't have to have word, we'd see it and hear it and feel it and maybe even get killed or badly burnt by it, if it were Dallas-Fort Worth, were destroyed in a nuclear attack. But eventually, armed forces, that is, local various gangs of people who would simply arm themselves and take away the means of survival from their neighbors, would prevail. In Germany, prior to World War II, they were in just such a situation. A lot of people don't understand how much crime there was in Germany, how much looting, how much street violence, just like has happened from a racial incident in Miami the other day. I remember when it happened, I was in Africa when the Watts riot happened back in the mid-1960s. I happened to be in Kenya. Around me, 100% of the people were black. And if there was anything I didn't want to do when I was in Kenya, Mr. Hunting and I were there together, it was riot. The last thing in my mind was to go out and demonstrate or to riot in the city there in which I found myself, because everybody was black. The headlines I'm reading in my hotel in the city, in the nation of Kenya, are huge riots in Los Angeles. And it told about the one white family that was merely trying to get to their home, and he unfortunately wandered through a part of Watts, and some blacks pulled his guy out of the car and literally beat his eyes right out of his head. Beat his head to a pulp. They killed, I don't know how many. They burnt that place practically to the ground. That was a terrible, terrible riot of racism. Well, they had racism of a different kind in Germany, and it's beginning to come back. Did you know within the last couple of weeks there have been some outstanding anti-Semitic incidents in Los Angeles? Do you know that there's quite a healthy percentage, if it's healthy, growing percentage of the United States citizens, especially the younger set, who do not believe that Hitler ever roast a single Jew? Do you know that practically the entire new generation, 30 and younger, in West Germany, believes the same thing? They are the product of their own educational system, and the entire Hitlerian era is buried in about two paragraphs and dispensed with very quickly in German textbooks. And they are the strength. They are now the young labor force. You know, 25 to 44 is your labor force, and below that, 18 to about 30 is your military force of a nation. And that generation of young Germans, 18 to 30, do not believe in the Holocaust. They don't believe that Hitler was guilty in World War II. Now, the older Germans began to cry for order. They wanted an end to crime, an end to riots. And mostly, they desperately wanted a scapegoat. That seems to be an evil of major governments, as well as sometimes churches and corporations. They've got deep-seated problems, maybe economic problems, maybe leaks out the bottom or whatever. The idea is, let's find us that one person who is a scapegoat. In this case, in Hitler, it was the Jewish race. There is something about Jews, and of course, understanding a little bit more about them than ever before, I can understand because of certain avarice, greed, and cunning that they have, which can be manifested in some individuals in particular. You can understand a little more why it is that many of the Gentile nations, and even the British in particular, have become fairly anti-Semitic. It takes a very converted person to love an unconverted Jew. A converted Jew, most lovable human being you've ever met. Jesus Christ was a Jew. The early New Testament church began with Jews. All the apostles save one, Simon the Canaanite, were Jewish. The Jews could never have had any opportunity to develop in the way that they have except inside the United States of America with its freedoms. The United States gave the Jew his great opportunity in finance, education, art, music, literature, government. They could never have soared to the heights they achieved in any other country simply because of the way the countries and their governments were set up. So the Jew has achieved his very greatest apex in all of those areas inside the United States. I don't think there has been a president of our country that has not had a very intelligent Jew very close to him as an advisor. Bernard Baruch was the advisor of many presidents, including FDR. Henry Kissinger, they call him Super Jew. And not without reason. He's a brilliant, intelligent man. You've heard of people, of course, such as Einstein, Rubinstein, and names like that, one in science, the other great pianist. And you've heard of George M. Cohan, one of America's patriotic songwriters. And of course, you know that many of our entertainers and Hollywood stars are Jewish, among them some of the women, female comedians and others, like Joan Rivers and so on, are Jewish. Well, you know, in Germany, the Jews tended to be shopkeepers. They tended to be financiers. They were haberdashers. And they were clothiers. And they were tailors. They went into business for themselves. Now, when these Germans were standing in the bread lines, basically, they were approaching the little Jew or his wife to sell them bread or to sell them meat because the butcher or the baker or the haberdasher was probably Jewish. In the meantime, the government itself, if you remember your history, was railing against the various Jewish bankers and the people suspected, including the Rothschilds. They had their conspiracy theories even in those days, who were manipulating or managing all of the money of the Western world. And, of course, eventually, anti-Semitic incidents such as the breaking of windows and the looting of Jewish shops began. And if you remember, one of the major events, sometime, I think, in the summer or so of 1937, don't quote the date, 37 or 38, they had what was called Kristallnacht, and they called it that because thousands of shop windows in cities all over Germany were destroyed, and because the glass just covering the street in cities all over Germany just shone like crystal in the streetlights as they looted thousands of stores, stole everything the Jews had accumulated. They called it in history Kristallnacht, Crystal Night, and of course, then we go from that to the pictures of the Jews being herded together into the cattle cars and sent off to the concentration camps. When I say we're at a time that is like a bizarre repetition of all of that, let me tell you that desecration of synagogues, writing of various slogans upon them, attacks upon Jewish shops and people, desecration of Jewish cemeteries, the turning over and the pouring of various paint and so on the headstones, is taking place in Germany now. Writers in Europe are saying that Germany now, you can go in the office and get you the quotes, and I'll put it in the articles coming up, is in a situation conducive to the emergence of a person such as Hitler. But it takes time. To make a statement, for me to just tell you here, preach a prophecy sermon on the United States of Europe, and to say, it's going to happen, sort of, quote, it's going to happen, end quote, this year. Well, what's going to happen? I want you to be in the picture to know exactly what to look for. What event triggers some other events, which triggers other events, and so on. When the economy collapses in West Europe, particularly in West Germany, you're going to see a cry for order and a cry for a very strong, powerful, firm hand to control the government. You'll see the nationalization of the banks, nationalization of industry, and, of course, a new national scrip or monetary medium of exchange, possibly based upon whatever gold reserves they have, but if not, simply a military type of money which will get them by in their own country temporarily. We see even now the government in the United States of America beginning to make tentative little steps in the same direction as did the Hoover and later on the FDR administration with the Townsend Plan, and when they created in my boyhood the nemesis hanging over their shoulders today, which of course is SS or Social Security, and they created in my boyhood the WPA and the three C's. Now those were volunteer, jobless hobos by the hundreds of thousands and the millions who went marching off to build little bridges, to work along the roadways and the shoulders of railways and roadways, marching with their shovels. But the same thing was happening in Italy. And you can see pictures of Mussolini stripped to the waist with his big, bulbous, bare chest out there with his shovel, and they would march with their shovels over their shoulders like soldiers off to the work. And they were doing the same thing in West Germany. Now they're going to tax you and me in the next few months, every time you fill your gas tank, 5 cents a gallon, 50 cents every 10 gallons, multiply that by 220 million people using gasoline. And they're going to create, in order to repair our bridges and our roads and our railway right-of-ways, a labor force paid by the government from the money they take from us in taxes, a new WPA, a new CCC, exactly as happened prior to World War II, and we have never had the kind of joblessness we have in the United States today since 1940. Today, we're exactly where we were in 1940. The same percentage of the labor force is out of work. We are in the offing of that time, if and when the American economy does collapse here in the next few years, where we will again see the homeless, the jobless, the hobo, by the tens of thousands, drifters, going from one town to the next, knocking on back doors, begging for a bowl of soup. I could get out of work when I was a kid by mom getting some split pea soup. I grew some peas in our own backyard once in a while, and she would give a hobo a cup of soup for stacking a cord of wood. Sometimes they would work half of the day or longer for a dime. And that's the way it was. And that would just fill their miserable bellies for maybe part of one day till they'd wander on and try to find somewhere else to work. Of course, in the meantime, we were doing the best we could to survive as well. But that's the way it was. And that is exactly what is going to lead to the emergence of despots, the searching for scapegoats, and a rise of dictatorships in Italy and in Germany, and believe it or not, in Japan. I want to talk about Japan for a minute, because Japan is not really noticed by many people. And I don't care what anybody else says. I was the very first one to actually see that, to perceive it. I don't know whether God gave me a little bit of a grasp of history and of a cyclical nature of history and the way world events occur or not, but long before anyone else paid any attention to Japan, I was writing letters about how Japan is going to be a future supergiant, and it said Japan will expand to the south, and that again its target will be the Malaysian area and the Australasian area and the extreme Western Pacific area and China. And I believe, as I read this book, and I would urge you to read it, At Dawn We Slept, that you will see such an incredible story of the stupidity of the obtuse miscalculation on the part of the American people, who simply did not believe that the Japanese could reach all the way from Japanese ports to Pearl Harbor, and therefore were sound asleep clear at 8 a.m. on that Sunday morning with the ships lined up nice and neatly ready for the Japanese to attack. And of course, for all practical purposes, the Japanese wiped out the entire U.S. Pacific fleet in one attack that took place over about 3.5 hours in Oahu on that one day. Most Americans were never told the real truth. Of course, the evidence is there and documented today. You can read the number of ships that were sunk, how the Oklahoma turned turtle, how many men died in the Arizona and the Utah, and all of the rest of them that went down. And that you can see then how many men were lost, how many aircraft were lost, and what happened in the Philippines, and how the ridiculous fears over Japanese saboteurs, and there was only basically one man, and he was the Japanese consul general on Oahu, who was engaged in espionage, but not sabotage, in the Hawaiian Islands, as you will read if you read the book. And so in order to prevent the Japanese saboteurs from blowing up all the B-17s and the fighter aircraft at Kaneohe or at Hickam or at Wheeler Air Force Base, why, they just lined them up in neat rows way out there in the concrete in the middle of the runways. So when the Japanese Zeros came in, they could just start strafing right down the row and knock out 50 aircraft in one run. It was almost as if some people thought the government, and you will find that that is not true. Millions of Americans swallow the idea that FDR arranged the whole thing because he knew the only way the United States government could get the people, who were basically isolationist and anti-war. Britain had already been through the worst part of her experience. The Battle of Britain, the Battle of London, was over by December 1940, and we weren't in it until a year later. And so we wanted to stay out of the war, and of course up to 50% of the major industrialists, including Henry Ford, wanted the government to stay out of the war, and were trying to force it to stay out of the war. If Nelson Rockefeller hadn't gone to South America, we would have had a backdoor problem. But Rockefeller took Disney and went to South America and won over everybody from Brazil to the Argentine. And in Argentina, they were goose-stepping to the swastika, remember, because Juan Perón had a military dictatorship and there were plenty of Germans in Argentina. If it hadn't been for Rockefeller, a lot of people think he's guilty. Of course, he's dead now as being one of the great conspirators. Nothing could be further from the truth. But in any event, when that occurred in Pearl Harbor, nobody really thought the Japanese were that advanced. They didn't think they could do it. They didn't think they could reach that far. I imagine that very few of you could name even the four main islands of Japan, let alone know very much about the nation of Japan. But having spent 9 years of my, 9 years, 9 months of my life in Japan and having visited it several times, at least I know a little bit, plus what I've read. But there are a lot of experts who know a great deal about Japan, and there is very great documentation available, not the least of which is Herman Kahn's Hudson Institute book, Japan, which is called, what did he call it, Emerging, it was several years after my booklet, after my article on the subject. It's something like the word either supergiant or giant of industry, Japan giant of industry or something like that, which I have at home, which is a documentary about the Japanese industry. Few of you probably know that Japan has launched nuclear-powered ships. She has nuclear-powered ships at sea. Few of you may know that now the Zen, you know, the Zero Zen, was their Mitsubishi fighter in World War II. Now they have a supersonic jet aircraft in their fighter aircraft squadrons today. And of course, very, very quickly, they could become a very powerful nuclear navy as well as a nuclear army. I want to skip again to the scene back here in our country and turn to some of the prophecies on the subject for a moment and to kind of put us ourselves into the picture. I don't believe that anything is going to come together in 1 year. Because I have preached for years, I happen to believe it. My father has preached the same thing, and I think he still believes it and hasn't forgotten it, and I think all the signs and portents are there that several of the nations of Central or Eastern Europe are going to become part of a United States of Europe, predominantly Poland. I cannot just write off the incredible mystery surrounding the death of the previous pope, the 180-degree turn from a conciliatory moderate to a powerful right-wing pope by the College of Cardinals in 6 weeks. It's hard to understand. We remember the final conclave by Malachi Martin that we talked about at the feast clear back in 1978. And of course, we also know, as I reported, merely basically upon observation and just intuition. I didn't have any data from anywhere, but if you remember back when we still had Internews, maybe it was then, or the International News, I said at the time of the assassination attempt on the Pope in the Vatican in St. Peter's Square that it was engineered by the KGB. Well, finally, 2 years later, all of the news are saying that these Hungarians are basically pawns of the Russian KGB in Hungary. And it's obvious that there were contacts there, that the man, as I said, who had access to a very expensive gun and first-class travel and first-class hotels and was all over Europe, and what major nation had the most to gain from trying to kill a pope who had just been to Poland to screaming audiences numbering up to 1 million in his native town, and of course all of the problems that resulted in the clamping of martial law and the incarceration of Lech Walesa, who had just now been let go, and martial law was taken off just this last week in Poland with very little change. Lech Walesa's learned his lesson. He's making very moderate little sounds, just wants to rest with his family. They put the fear of the KGB in him. He's scared half to death. It's going to take quite a while for a new round of solidarity or anything else to try to throw off the yoke of communism and to convert that to national socialism inside Poland, let alone Czechoslovakia and perhaps Romania and Hungary. And that has to happen. Why should I stand here and tell you it's all going to come down in 1 year, or even 2 years, or even 3 years, when it's more likely to take up to 9 or 10 years before it really comes together and the actual blow begins to fall on the United States that commences World War III? I don't have any magic ball. I have the same time-honored prophecies I've always had. Now let's look at one of the most important of all in Daniel, the 11th chapter. Daniel 11 is one of the most pivotal prophecies in all of the Bible for the time in which we live right now, and also that has to do with the prophecy of 2 Thessalonians 2 and Revelation 17. Those are fairly simple prophecies, and from those, you could say we can use as a springboard to many other prophecies in the Bible that I won't take time with today. Verse 40, "And at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him." Question, who is the king of the south? Answer, nobody knows. If I were to stand here and tell you all these things are going to happen in 1 year, guess what I'm trying to tell you? I'm trying to tell you that a global economic collapse will occur. I'm trying to tell you that a North African Arabic bloc of nations will emerge with a king or a great super ruler of some sort, like a military dictator at its head. I'm trying to tell you that OPEC will collapse. Because, of course, along with the international financial institutions, OPEC goes down the drain. That NATO will collapse. That mounting protectionism, nations going it alone in world trade, scrambling for their own markets, clamping embargoes and sanctions and surcharges and high tariffs on each other once again to keep cheaply made foreign goods out and to try to get their own goods sold to nations abroad and so on. And I'm trying to tell you all this is going to happen in 1 year. The dictators are going to emerge everywhere between February and June, and then their armies are going to come like mushrooms out of the ground somewhere, and their nuclear arsenals from between June to August. And then by November, while they're going to have massive fleets of 10,000 intercontinental 8,000-mile range bombers to deliver their missiles, that are cruise missiles or MX or intercontinental ballistic missiles, including Japan and West Germany by that time, it can't happen that fast. Now, God can accelerate events and simply cut short some of the scenario I'm telling you about, because it does say, as for prophecies, they shall fail. But if these events are going to occur, I can't even identify for you yet who is the king of the south. It is not Mubarak. I don't believe it is the present king of Saudi Arabia. Whatever this push is, shall push at him. And I think it is very, very logical that it has to do with the cutting off of oil. It has to do with an embargo of the flow of energy. Now, who is most dependent upon Middle Eastern energy? Japan is number one. West Europe is number two. West Europe gets some of their oil, as does Japan, from North Africa, from Nigeria, and a little bit from South America, predominantly Venezuela. But most of it comes from the Middle East, and most of it flows from the area around Crack Island, and of course, I should say Karg Island, and through the Straits of Hormuz, and therefore comes from the Persian Gulf kingdoms, the various Arab states, mostly Saudi Arabia. At the time of the end, shall the king of the south push at him, that is the king of the north. And the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind. It happens quickly. Hitler, as you know, of course, invented the term lightning war, which is all a word Blitzkrieg really meant. With chariots, substitute tanks. And with horsemen, and you can substitute armored troops and so on. And with many ships, no substitution necessary. And he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. That's showing that not only that one grouping of countries, but others nearby. Several countries, plural, involved. He shall enter also into the glorious land. That is Palestine, capital city, again, Jerusalem, not Tel Aviv. And many countries shall be overthrown. Now, you know, just a couple of points in passing. I don't know how people get so far off the mark. There are many people, even in the Church of God International, who are listening to the various conspiracy theories. Is the mark of the beast a credit card? Is it a little striated thing on a cellophane wrapper on some ginger snaps that you take through the supermarket? I mean, people are going crazy. It is not the mark of the United States of America. It is not the mark of our economy. It is not the mark of Piggly Wiggly or Kroger's checkout stand. It is not the mark of your Social Security card. It is the mark of the beast. Now, who is the beast? Well, the beast is going to be the same grouping of nations that has always been the beast in prophecy, which will emerge in Central Europe. What will be its identifying mark? I remind you again that the national currency of Germany is called the mark. I remind you, the national currency of France is called the mark, except it's in French, which is called franc. But in French, that means mark. Ours is called the thaler, from a valley in Germany, T-H-A-L-E-R, which came down in our anglicized version to the dollar. It is not the mark. And it does have to do with buying or selling, as you will bear in mind. So, if he's going to enter into the glorious land, you've got to ask the question, why? Is this an artifice? Now, I am beginning to wonder. You know, I did not know until after I went over to visit Sadat, and the year after that, when he went to Tel Aviv, and then I began preaching on many and many a platform before large audiences, that this prophecy could not have really been understood until after the beginning of the Camp David process and the mending of some fences between Egypt and Israel. Now I'm beginning to wonder, first time I've ever speculated aloud, first time I've ever said this, doesn't this also seem to strongly imply that the Israelis are going to temporarily seem to settle their differences with Saudi Arabia? Doesn't it seem to imply that? Who is the king of the south? Whoever the king of the south is, he is somehow together with the Israeli government. Or else you could not justify the king of the north coming into the Middle East and occupying both the native country of the king of the south, not identified here, either Saudi Arabia or Egypt or an agglomeration of several Arab states, and occupy the land of Palestine. They've got to be together. They can't be enemies. They've got to be both together and the object of the wrath of this European power. He shall enter into the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom, which we certainly do believe is Turkey, and Moab, and the chief of the children of Ammon. Now, Ammon, as you know, is the capital city of Jordan, and of course the Ammonites are those Arabs that are over in that area. The Moabites, I imagine, are the Syrians, the Iraqis, the Iranians, or other people, or Turkoman, and not Arab, even though they have an Arab religion. That is Iran. Iraq are Arabs, basically. And the chief of the children of Ammon, or Ammon. Why do they escape out of his hand? Apparently, the dividing line right down the Jordan River, and right now between the western part of Palestine, including the nation of Lebanon, of Palestine itself, or of Israel, of Egypt, and Saudi Arabia, and to the east of there, including perhaps Iraq, Iran, Syria, I believe, and Jordan, are in apparently the communist sphere of influence, cooperating with them to some degree. And that may give you a clue as to which way King Hussein will finally go. He shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. So you have definite information that Egypt and Israel are going to be occupied by a multilateral European force under the King of the North. He shall have power over the treasures of gold and of silver. And of course, you know, petrodollars are there in their hundreds of billions by now. And over all the precious things of Egypt and the Libyans, and that means Cush and Put in the original language. And I don't believe it means Libya today under Muammar Gaddafi, but it does apparently mean those nations further down in the Sahara Belt, and it means the nations further over to the east, meaning India and Pakistan, who probably are Put. And the Kushites are those very tall black people of North Africa, primarily in the Sudan, Ethiopia, and further south, and in the Sahara belt of the Sahara African countries such as Chad and Domi and some of the others. Not Libya. Libya may well be part of those nations included in the statement also upon the countries, as will perhaps the entirety of Tripolitania and several nations there. Algeria, Tunisia, Libya might all go down at the same time Egypt does. Now what? How are we going to escape Daniel 11:40? In writing any article, in telling anyone in any pulpit at any time, what will be the setting, what will be the beginning of World War III? This is the act that apparently begins to precipitate World War III. Now I want you to turn to Jesus' prophecy in Matthew 24 and get some sense of this, keeping in mind that Jesus talked about a time when a person would be outdoing some sort of daily endeavor that he is just commonly engaged in. But let's read up to it, beginning with the prophecy that even has to do with the work of God going out. Verse 14, "And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations." I am not attacking anyone when I tell you that I do not believe for one instant that that work has even scratched the surface. I don't believe it has even begun to be done, and I do not believe for an instant that the gospel of the kingdom of God is what was ringing in the ears of hundreds and thousands of people from Lesotho to the Gold Coast and from Tokyo to Nice. I do not believe give and get and so on, and I won't, you know, regale this subject or go over it too much here to go off on a tangent somewhere, is the preaching of the gospel of the kingdom. If it is a witness, it is a witness, as the Bible makes it very clear, against them as much as for them. It is a testimony. It is a witness. It is not to convict them or to convince them or to convert them. Of course, most of the major Gentile nations are going to be witnessed to and are going to be converted, if you read Isaiah 65 and 66 very carefully, when Christ, in the second half of his 3.5-year ministry, is going to go to the lands of the coastlands, and Cush and Put are again mentioned in that prophecy, and many other Gentile nations, and they will begin to hear the word. So to what extent the Gentile nations have to be reached, and to what extent this means all the lost sheep of the house of Israel, would perhaps be debatable. Because it says, "You shall not have gone over the cities of Israel before the Son of Man be come," in the 10th chapter of the book of Matthew. "For a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end come. Now, when you therefore shall see the abomination of desolation," do you see it? Do you know what it is? We know what it was in the past. There were several events in the past to which you can point, not the least of which, of course, was the desecration of the temple by Antiochus Epiphanes, and then again by Titus, and then the setting up later on of the original wooden structure called the Mosque of Omar, and then the building of the gold gilt mosque, which is there on the site of the Dome of the Rock today. And the Gentiles are treading down Israel. I should say they're treading down Jerusalem, because, of course, old Jerusalem is basically Arabic, even today. Even though it's under Israeli military control, the Arabs live there, and the old city, The very site of the city of David is basically in the control, right nearby it, of the Arab people. So it is not until you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet. Now Daniel, of course, did not give us a whole lot of detail. We look in history at the desecration of the temple, an abomination that brought about desolation. We look at the attack by Titus, who even had his soldiers prize the huge rocks and stones of the buildings and the outer wall loose and send them crashing down below and completely try to level the site of the temple that stood during the Herodian period when Jesus was there and when the early apostles were there and preaching on the day of Pentecost. It was all destroyed. It was all leveled. And going down now and digging down underneath, you get to the original stones that were there, the very stones that Christ and the disciples walked by and looked at when they told him at the beginning of this prophecy, look at all these marvelous buildings. And those have been covered by the dust and the debris of nearly 2,000 years from that time to this, at the time of that destruction. Do you see this yet? Do you even see it beginning to get started yet? I'm not crying wolf, wolf in reverse, saying it can't happen suddenly. Saying it can't happen a year after it next or anything like that. I'm not saying that. Bear that in mind. I'm saying that basically prophecies of the past have always come to pass as a result of dozens of very easily measurable and discernible events which a carnal-minded person could track for you, which historians have put down in books, and none of these history books that I avail myself of, from Rawlinson's World History to any of the rest of them that talk about the collapse of the great city-states and empires of the past, ever quote the Bible. None of them ever quote the Bible. They quote the events that led to the great battles like Actium and the defeat of Alexander the Great in 331 B.C. and so on. They don't quote the rough goat and the division into the four winds. They don't tell you it's Nabonidus and it's Seleucus Nicator and it's Ptolemy Soter of Egypt, and that before the body of Alexander was even buried, his four generals carved up the empire into four areas of the compass at all. They don't quote the Bible. They don't quote Daniel, who actually named Cyrus. One of the prophets did by name, Isaiah, I believe, 400 years before he was born. No, you look in history, and then history corroborates the Bible, but historians don't quote the Bible. So the great events of the present and of the immediate future, you're not going to see a lot of biblical quotations from news writers and from magazine writers and so on showing you why it came to pass. But you have to know that you're looking for the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, stand in the holy place. Now, the only place you could call holy today, generally, if you look in the news and they speak of the holy places, what are they talking about? They're talking about three religions. They're talking about the so-called Western religion of Christendom, which includes Catholic and Protestant, and they're talking about the Jewish holy places, such as the alleged tomb of David and so on, and the sarcophagus is there that they keen and wail and lick and pray over, and of course Mark was over there for quite a little span of time and he's seen all of this happening and so on. Or they're talking about the Wailing Wall and their little notes they put in the crevices and stand there and bow and pray for hours till their back nearly gets out of place. Or they're talking about the Muslims and their Dome of the Rock. Christian, Islamic, and Jewish, those are the holy places. That isn't what this means. I still say that if we are to understand 2 Thessalonians 2 literally, that is, that some great false antichrist will be standing in the temple of God, showing that he is God, and will have power to call down great miracles in the sight of men to completely just so fascinate them that millions of people will just suddenly join with the Catholic Church and will say he is the Vicar of Christ and he is the Holy Father and so on. And that's going to take massive, startling miracles for him to do so, then strange events have got to take place inside the city of Jerusalem. Is the Dome of the Rock going to be destroyed? Is some other building going to be erected near it or next to it? Is a temporary building going to be put up as a result of a fantastic return to fervent nationalistic Jewish religion? What would it take to bring about a fanatic return to Judaism in basically irreligious Israel? Nothing short of the threat of another Holocaust. Virtual threat of Israeli extermination. Nothing short of a terrible loss of territory. Will the Reagan administration, I think the answer is yes, and Western Europe succeed in putting enough pressure on the Israelis? Are we right now at the point, it looks like they're going to bring Hussein in, where real meaningful talks, not only having to do with the Israeli withdrawal from Lebanon, but the creation of a separate state on the West Bank and Gaza, will actually occur? Will that ever happen? I don't think it will, short of some kind of warfare. The Israelis are not going to allow it, but warfare is not unthinkable in that region. And the idea that this time the Western allies would not come to the Israeli aid, and that perhaps Russian-supported Arabs would make good their aim and would reoccupy that area, is not totally out of the realm of possibility. I don't know exactly, but I know that they're never going to give up their claims for their homeland in the Palestinians, that is, in the West Bank. Now, some national calamity has got to occur before the Jewish government is only ever going to authorize the building of a holy place and start maybe even actual sacrifices again in the streets of Jerusalem. That has to happen before the holy place stands. Then the King of the South has to become evident. The King of the South has to push at the King of the North, meaning the King of the North has to become evident. We have to know who he is. The world trading situation has to collapse before the King of the South pushes at the King of the North. All that has to happen before the King of the North attacks into the Holy Land. And then is when you see the abomination of desolation. And then is when it says, let him that be in Judea flee to the mountains. It doesn't say him that be in Tyler, Texas. And it doesn't say him that be in Pasadena, California, or Sydney, Australia, or Detroit, Michigan. It says, let him that be in Judea flee to the mountains. Now, remember what we said from Daniel 11. Let's project our thoughts forward, and let's be an Israeli in perhaps Tel Aviv at the point in time where this multilateral European force has suddenly come in there. There are ships offshore. Huge aircraft have been landing at Lud Airport for days. Troops are debarking everywhere. And there is an occupying army in place as a peacekeeping force. Jerusalem is encircled. The Pope has declared it an open city. He has made declarations, by the way, to that effect already, you know. They call it Corpus Separatum. And, of course, the Pope has called for a separate corpus, an open, totally separate city. And that language is used in international documents for years, so far as the old city of Jerusalem is concerned, so that mortars and bombs and rockets and bullets would never destroy the holy places of the city of Jerusalem. Now the Pope is in place. He is there. He is calling for peace. There's been a giant spurt of fighting around the world. It looks like World War III is about to start, but the Pope says, no, let's calm it, let's cool it, let's have peace, let's not have war. And a time of comparative peace descends. The King of the North has what he wants. He's got his oil and his energy. He's got all of the banks and all of the loot and the money and so on. And Israel is occupied. Now, people are going about their daily lives. And it says, verse 17, when you first see this, let him which is on the housetop not come down to take anything out of his house. Why would he be on the housetop? The housetop is only used for two or three things: sunning, visiting, sleeping, or hanging up your laundry. The housetop in Israel, and we had a housetop like that in our office, we would go up for those purposes. Neither let him which is in the field. Why would he be in a field? Well, harvesting, planting, working, return back to take his clothes. Now, this is something that happens so suddenly, and it is so imminent and so immediate to the very fields or the front door where these people live, that you are not here seeing people watching television of something which is happening, some great massive invasion. These are people which have been living with a fairly comfortable status quo. Suddenly, something electrifying in the air changes. A different occurrence takes place. Suddenly, something occurs that they see, and they see happen. And what is that? When you shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet stand in the holy place. Now look at Luke 21:20. I won't turn to that. It says, when you see Jerusalem surrounded with armies. It's twofold. the holy places, meaning the Pope standing in a place which will be designated as a holy place, making his great pronouncements, and armies, plural, not one army of one nation, but a multilateral force, many armies encircling Jerusalem, then it is time to flee. Verse 19, woe to them that are with child and them that give suck in those days. But pray you that your flight be not in the winter. This is the land of Palestine. That prophecy of our Savior makes no sense at all applied to a global church. God is not a respecter of persons. He is not going to say to the people in Hobart, Tasmania, well, tough luck, I've decided to hear the prayers of the people in Alaska. Because somebody's going to come up in the short end. Either all of the brethren of the church from that band south of the equator, at about equivalent to the 40th parallel and below, are going to be left out in the cold, or those north of the equator and above are going to be left out in the cold, aren't they? Somebody's prayer is not going to be answered, because it's always winter somewhere in the world. And the Australians and the New Zealanders and the South Africans and whatever people are scattered through South America very thinly, well, they'll be left out in the cold if God answers the prayer of the northern hemisphere. No, this is talking about Judea. It's talking about Jerusalem. For then shall be great tribulation, and the church has always preached and taught, and my father has always preached and taught. And the Bible, I believe, proves that. And we can see it in Jeremiah, the 31st chapter and the 7th verse, that the great tribulation is the time of Jacob's trouble, meaning the calamities coming upon the nation of Israel, meaning the United States and Britain and so on and all the rest of them. Then shall be great tribulation. When? Before you see the abomination of desolation standing in the holy place? Before the attack of the King of the North, which sets the stage for this to happen? It can only happen with that force in there to allow him to take that position? Look, if the King of the North attacks into the Middle East, the Pope goes down there to prevent its destruction. The King of the North's attack precipitates the move of the Pope. The Pope then begins to call for peace, and he produces his miracles, but that is the abomination of desolation. And then comes the Great Tribulation. Then comes the attack of Europe upon the United States. When would anyone who lived in Tyler, Texas flee? Let's go ahead a little bit and see something that people have totally turned around, upside down and backward for years in the church. In conclusion here, to bring this to a close, there's a great deal more I can tell you about, but I'll save that for some of the articles. Let's look in verse 36. But of that day and hour, now this is talking about after the tribulation, the heavenly signs, verse 30, the sign of the Son of Man shall appear. So we're skipping ahead now 3.5 years past the tribulation and day of the Lord, through the plagues, and until the time of the second coming of Christ. Now we go back in verse 36 saying, of that day and hour, meaning the time of the second coming of Christ, knows no man, no, not the angels of heaven, but my Father only. But as the days of Noah were, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be, and this is a warning for us. Read that book, please. Don't just put it in your notes and say, all right, I'm not going to read it. If it's tedious, force yourself, but read it. At dawn we slept. The parallels are unbelievable. Read about Gru, our ambassador over there. You probably didn't know, and I'd forgotten. I did know at one time, but he was married to the granddaughter of Perry, Commodore Perry, who opened the Japanese trade to the West in the first place. Joseph Grew, who was our ambassador to Japan in the pre-World War II days, married Perry's granddaughter. And he was an ardent devotee of Japanese culture. He loved the Japanese people. Quite an astute man. Read that book. It's really incredible. This is a warning to us because there could have been no more complacency than there was on Oahu at all those installations and aboard those ships when they had warning after warning after warning for more than a year. They had a sighting of two Japanese subs, including a big one and a midget sub. They had a radar contact. They actually had intercepted traffic through their breaking of the Japanese code. They had every reason to know. And because of just stupid mistakes of people saying, mailing a letter on Friday knowing it wouldn't go out till Monday, I mean, you can't believe it, but you've got to read it. And it certainly does bring home these words. As in the days that were before the flood, they were eating and drinking, just living life normally, marrying and giving in marriage, living life normally, until the day that Noah entered into the ark and knew not until the flood came and, read the next words, took them all away. Now, who was left in their location? Why, Noah and his family. They'd been living aboard that big ship. That was their headquarters. It'd been 120 years since they'd been living in that thing. They were there in protection, in a place of safety. Who was taken away, just swept away by flood tides and disappeared, went to some other geographical location, bobbing along like bloated corpses on the water? Well, all those who didn't listen to the preaching of Noah. So shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. Then, same subject, talking about people in an attitude like in the pre-Noahian deluge, shall two be in the field. The one shall be taken. Oh, that means taken to a place of safety. Is that right? Is that honest with the Bible? You've heard of mixed metaphors. Does the Bible just mix metaphors all of a sudden? Taken away to a place of safety? The one is taken, the other left. They didn't know until a flood came and took them all away. I maintain that they've had it backwards in their understanding for years, and that the one who is taken is the one who is arrested, seized, dragged off, taken into the proverbial, you know, concentration camp, and the other is left, meaning left behind. He can be protected wherever God wishes to protect him. It doesn't really matter. You don't have to understand this academically. I'm just saying that the scenario that many people have depicted, which is a part of the idea of everyone fleeing on some moment in time, where you sell your home and you sell your property, you sell your car, and you send the money someplace, and you stand there like a guy waiting to run the 100-yard dash at your front door, and it would make no sense at all to me, because look how exhausted the people in L.A. would be by the time they got to Tyler. And where do we flee? We try to catch up with those folks in Brooklyn or New York, standing there waiting for a ship to take them somewhere. Where do you flee to? I mean, if you were going to flee right now, if I were going to flee from where I live out at Emerald Bay, I'll tell you where I'd flee. I'd just lock the doors, because I don't know where else I could flee to. I live there by a lake. Maybe there's some woods nearby, but where am I going to flee to? I'm just going to flee to some big city where it's going to be hideous and worse than any place else? If God is going to take his church, that's in God's hands, and he will do it. No man can prevent it. And the key is, are you ready? If you're ready, it doesn't matter. You don't have to concoct some scenario and believe in that and then store your honey and sesame seeds and say, I've got my cave in Petra reserved for me, and believe in that, but a whole church has found itself doing exactly that and believing in that kind of a scene. And it's preached and it's taught and it's hoped for, and they talk about it and whisper about it and are excited about it and expect it continually, but it's not taught in the Word of God. Two women shall be grinding at the mill. Well, that's daily work. We got a little mill out at our house. My wife can plug it in, and she can take whole grain wheat and make me some cracked wheat cereal. Shows two of them side by side. What is the difference? They're in the same physical locality. The difference is what is in here. The difference is their spiritual quality. One of them has the seal. One of them has God's Holy Spirit. One of them is converted, and one is not. Now, the one who is taken, I would think, is the one who is taken away. And the one who is left is the one who was not molested. Again, look at World War II. You read the diary of Anne Frank, maybe. Maybe you saw the movie, hiding out in attics. Some of the incredible tortures of people in that day that would hear the staff car and hear the boots coming up the stairs and the big knock on the stairs and the knock on the door, and would be scared half out of their wits because they have come to take the family away. And if you go through the Yad Vashem and you look at all the pictures, and of course they're there to instruct you and to remember what it was like and what it is yet going to be like, because they are going to be arresting people and people are going to be taken. Now, who is going to be left and who is going to be taken? I say that those who are protected, whichever category you want to put them in, are those that we see pictured in the writer's inkhorn prophecy of Ezekiel, who sigh and cry for the abominations around them, and who are those who are among the 144,000 or the great innumerable multitude and the church of God, who have the Holy Spirit of God and who do not receive the mark of the beast. Will the mark of the beast be, by this time, a literal tattoo, a literal identifying mark of some sort? And will that have to do with who is arrested and who is not? I don't know that we will know the answers to all of those things perfectly before it really begins to happen. But it does say, verse 42, watch therefore, for you know not what hour your Lord doth come. And over in Luke 21 and verse 36, it says the same thing. Watch you, therefore, and pray always that you might be accounted worthy to escape all these things. Doesn't say to escape from a place, but to escape things that shall come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man. There is a great deal more I could tell you, especially the attitude of the Japanese and Europeans over Reaganomics, but I'll save that for some of the articles coming up. One announcement in conclusion, we've been talking a good deal about it. It's not by way of an announcement, merely the fact that it's in the talking stages that hopefully by May, June, we will once again be able to publish an edition of Watch magazine. I'm hopeful that we can. I want to shoot for at least a quarterly, and maybe the following year, 6 issues a year, and if God wills, the following year, every month. But I think that this series of articles and others like it, if you've noticed recently in the newspaper, you will notice that even on the front page, very little of it is really news. We will continue the newspaper, lock it in at 8 pages, try to encourage people to give us more and more church news and have it timely. But of course, right now, basically you will see prophetic articles, doctrinal articles, Christian living articles, Mr. Dark series on the Bible versus critics, and so on, going on time and again in the international news. And by that time, it'll be more of a church newspaper, and perhaps we can crank up the magazine. And if we can, I want to tell those along the tape program here who will be hearing this a week from today that we will probably run an overprint of approximately 3,000 to 5,000 copies. And we will ask every one of the local brethren, once again, if they want to start their own newsstand program, to tell us in advance how many they believe that they can safely and without, wasting them, dispose of in a newsstand program that the local brethren could be involved with to help us build that mailing list. They will send us their orders. We'll try to print that many above what our own normal mailing list would be, and hopefully we'll be off and running by mid-spring with a magazine again, hopefully with a color cover, but with black and white in the interior. And we're getting the facts on it. We're trying to find out how much it's going to cost. And we think with maybe planning for only maybe 3 issues in 1983, and then 6 in 1984, and then 1 month, 12 issues in 1985 and thereafter, that we will be back publishing a beautiful magazine again. And I think articles of this type deserve it. Nothing's older than yesterday's news, and people don't even tend to keep those. They throw them away or use them to start a fire. Or people generally don't throw away a beautiful magazine with a color cover. They will keep it around, and it has durable and lasting value. So I hope you'll pray about that and keep it in mind, and those along the tape program can keep it in mind as well. We haven't made a definite decision. We're still wanting to, evaluate the financial aspects of it. But if and when the green light is given, we'll certainly give that a go. Well, I'll be saying so long temporarily for 2 Sabbaths at least. Mr. Dart will be with you the next couple of Sabbaths, and I'll appreciate your prayers for a safe trip up to Vancouver, B.C. in return.